Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to Bookomi, original, memorable insights, OMI, from books by the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode...
Hi everyone, I'm Elif Shafak, author of How to Stay Sane in an Age of Division, and this is my OMI for Bookomi.
We meet the world-renowned writer, political scientist, campaigner, speaker, literary judge, and multiculturalist, who wants us all to rebuild our polarized and troubled world with humanity and respect for stories beyond our own mental and physical borders.
We are made of stories, and also what we remember mostly through stories. As we go back in time, as we dig into our own memories, it's always about how we felt in that moment in time. So feelings, perceptions, emotions are incredibly important.
Elif Shafak is herself a powerful storyteller. Her works of fiction and non-fiction and her global TED Talks have touched the hearts and minds of millions of people in 50 different languages on the planet. Her latest book, How to Stay Sane in an Age of Division, is a short but fluent survey of the collective narcissism threatening to pull nations apart at a time when we all face the same immediate existential threats of pandemic, climate change, and nuclear war. How do we stop fear and anxiety about the future turning into disillusion and bewilderment? Even without the pandemic, domestic politics and wealth inequality are building walls between us every day. Elif, welcome to Bookomi.
Thank you so much.
The world outside looks pretty crazy at the moment, doesn't it? And you as a writer are particularly sensitive to its mood and its stories. How do you personally stay sane with so many stories swirling around you?
Yeah, I think this is a question that we should be asking ourselves. And I believe it's okay not to feel okay, you know? That's my starting point, because so much is changing so fast, and the ground beneath our feet does not feel solid anymore. There's a lot of uncertainty, whether it's the economy we're talking about, society, our mental health, the future of the job market, you name it. And of course, the climate emergency, which is so central. So in every which way, there's lots of uncertainties that we should be frankly facing and talking about. And under these circumstances, my starting point is it's okay to be anxious. It's okay to be angry, but we cannot stay there. We cannot remain there. What do we do with that anger? What do we do with this anxiety? How do we find a way forward from here?
So as individuals, you say we're made of stories, multiple stories that weave through our life, our relationships and our imagination. Collectively, as nations or cultures, is this why we're bonded to people who share the same story as our own? So when we feel under threat, we reject stories and cultures that are different to our own.
I think that's very true. We are made of stories. And also what we remember mostly through stories. Think about it. As we go back in time, as we dig into our own memories, it's always about how we felt in that moment in time. So feelings, perceptions, emotions are incredibly important. And I find it very problematic that in particularly political science, mostly it's statistics and data and quantitative research, which by no means I'm underestimating. Of course, it's incredibly important. But all I'm saying is emotions should also matter, especially in an age in which emotions guide and misguide politics and also are guided by politics in return. So I think we need to put emotional analysis at the center of our debates. We need to have more frank debates about anxiety, anger, fear, resentment, bitterness. All of those negative feelings do to us. And when I say us, not only as individuals, but also as collective identities, as groups, sometimes as tribes, sometimes as nations. So I want to talk about collective emotions as well.
Is that what you mean by collective narcissism, when we think as nations that the world revolves around us?
We have been told for a long time that the world was divided into solid countries and liquid countries in a way. I'm using metaphors here, but that was the essence of what we have been told. In other words, we have been told, particularly in late 1990s and early 2000s, when there was too much optimism across the world, that history could move only in one direction, and it had to be linear, progressive, that thanks to the movement of capital, ideas, the movement of digital technologies particularly, the world was going to become so deeply interconnected that democracy was going to spread everywhere, east and west, and those countries that were lagging behind would sooner or later have to catch up with the rest of the civilized world. And that kind of assumption, I think, also brought along a certain arrogance or complacency. It made people think that human rights, women's rights, LGBTQ rights, freedom of speech, rule of law, all of these issues were matters that people in less developed countries had to worry about. They had to fight for these values, but not the citizens of the Western world, because the Western world was thought to be far beyond that threshold anyhow. But I think particularly after the year 2016, more and more people realized that there is no such thing as solid countries versus liquid countries. And in fact, we're all living in liquid times. And what that means is even those countries that seem to be democratic and fully developed and well advanced, they too can go backward. It too can happen here. And we all need to be more engaged citizens. We all need to care about women's rights and human rights, not only the citizens of some nations, you know, far away.
We forget that civilizations have grown and empires have grown and fallen before, when people thought that their way of life was eternal, that their way of life would never be changed. It's almost as if we don't learn from history that we get obsessed with ourselves in the present. Is that why you think that we're turning to more strong men leadership models and authoritarian regimes?
Well, unfortunately, that is part of the reason. And as you said, there was a time when it seemed like liberal democracy was the only triumphant ideology that could survive in the long run, because the Berlin Wall had come down, the Soviet Union was no more. It looked like fascism had failed, communism had failed. So it was just liberal democracy without any alternatives. And I think it also brought along this assumption that places like China or Russia or Turkey, they would also, as they became more, as time went by, and let's say they embraced capitalism, that was the assumption, democracy would happen automatically. And I think all those assumptions were so mistaken, so flawed. And there was some arrogance underneath as well. The critical moment that we're experiencing right now is there are some very real problems that we need to talk about, starting with inequality. But populism, particularly populist right, populist nationalism, this is a false answer, a fake answer to some very real problems. The problems are real. What is fake is the assumption, is the expectation that populist demagogues can solve those problems. But unfortunately, in country after country, we have seen this tendency to look for so-called strong men. And it's very ironic, because we've also seen how those so-called strong men have been failing to deal with the coronavirus crisis, again in country after country. So I think we have arrived at a very, very crucial crossroads. And the decisions that we will make right now will affect generations to come in a very dramatic way.
Yeah, I can hear you through clenched teeth say the word strong men, because the notion of what is strong and to be a strong leader, it's almost like linguistically, and we'll get to that in a minute, that we have to redefine terms. You know, you talk about half-destroyed dictionary in the book, that our whole language, our whole sense of meaning has been disrupted by the political and economic and, you know, climatic situations around us. Let's talk about stories before we talk about language. Stories are so important to you, and your story is one of multitudes, multiple belongings, born in Strasbourg, raised in Turkey by a conservative grandmother while your mum trained to become a diplomat, traveling the world as an academic in the USA and the UK, which is now your home. Now, this is an exceptional nomadic experience of the world. How do people who stay in the same country or city or village even get to see the world in different ways like you?
I think as human beings, we're all composed of multiple voices, multiple selves. And we know this from our lives. In fact, we're not exactly the same person. Think about it. As we as we communicate with our children, another part of us is maybe a bit more dominant. When we talk with our own parents, we become children again. With our friends, we're a little bit different. And I think there are lots of layers, threads that compose an individual. That is why every human being is incredibly complicated. It might be the team, the football team you support. It might be your ethnic belongings. Maybe there are lots of stories in your family, your ancestors. They came from very different parts of the country. I think even if you do not leave the town where you were born and raised, you still have multiple belongings. But the problem is, in the age we're living in, when we go to school, when we turn on the TV, when we hear a certain narrative again and again, we learn that we can only have one identity, at least one dominant identity. We have to choose something and stick to it all throughout our lives. We are not being taught that, in fact, we have multiple belongings. And to me, this is very sad, because if I can understand my own multiple belongings, and if someone else can see their own multiple belongings, there's a bigger chance that we can find what we have in common, as opposed to if I see myself as one solid monolithic identity, and if the other person sees themselves in that way, then clashes are inevitable. So to me, it's very sad that the age we're living in constantly encourages nationalism, isolationism, tribalism, and teaches us how we are different from others, but not exactly what we have in common or how complicated each and every individual is at the end of the day.
Your relationship with Istanbul is complicated, and you say that Turkey, Istanbul, is your motherland. You use the metaphor actually of a castle made of glass, which you have to shatter to leave, but then you carry its shards with you in your pockets through life. Does it still hurt to think of your motherland, and why?
I think it will always hurt, perhaps, because many immigrants, many refugees, many exiles, expats feel this way. And it's very difficult to talk about it because it's quite abstract. But the fact that you're living physically in one city, one country, doesn't mean you can't be emotionally attached to another place or to another continent at the same time. And I think living particularly in some kind of exile means that your mind is also attached emotionally. Your heart is attached to another land. And at the same time, I also feel a strong sense of belonging towards the UK, London, this country where I feel free to write, to speak up. That is why for me it's very important to emphasize multiple belongings. I am an Istanbulite, you know, and I think that will always be with me. Wherever I go, that's not going to change. And anyone who reads my work can see that Istanbul as a she city, because I think Istanbul is a female city, is very much present in my writings, not as a background decor, not as a setting, but as a character on her own. That said, I also feel attached to the Balkans. I have so many elements in my soul from the Middle East. You know, put me next to a Lebanese author, an Egyptian, a Jordanian author, a Syrian author. I have so much in common. At the same time, I'm a European by birth. The values that I share and I uphold. I have become a Londoner, a British citizen over the years. And despite what our politicians have been telling us recently, I still would like to think of myself as a citizen of the world. That does not mean you're a citizen of nowhere. It does not mean you have no sense of belonging or responsibility. It doesn't mean you're floating in the air aimlessly. Just the opposite. It means I can care, we can care about multiple things at the same time, simultaneously.
It's incredible, the nomadic experience that you're talking about, but you're not talking about being lost or wandering in the sense of the word, are you? In the old sort of poetic terms, Anglo-Saxon poetry terms of, you know, the notion of the wanderer constantly looking for their home. The way you talk about belonging and history and multiple belongings, they're all part of you. You gather something together in each place you live, and it becomes part of your heart and your past and your future. And that's a very interesting way to look at the way you have embraced language and how you even learned to write, which wasn't in, you know, an easy process. You had to learn in a slightly, well, left-handed way, which wasn't the norm in the school that you were taught. And the way that you've embraced language and English language means that you can tell by the way you write that you treat it with care. You know, you don't, you appreciate what you've got maybe more than people who've only grown up with only knowing one language. And it's the lifeblood of your work. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that and language as a sense of identity, which we mentioned a bit earlier, because you say that we're at a crossroads now, a threshold in time where we hold half destroyed dictionaries, which is a terrible, you know, a terribly impactful phrase that in our hands, that discrimination always starts with language. What do you mean by that? What do you mean by discrimination always starts with language?
I think memory is a responsibility, and we need to study history. We need to over and over reread, but not, I'm not talking about necessarily official history, but different historical accounts of minorities, people who have been silenced, disempowered, to see how they went through things and learn from each other as human beings. So when we look at history, we realize that it doesn't start with concentration camps. It does not start with mass incarcerations, mass graves. It always starts with language. So the darkest chapters in human history come after that distortion in language. What I mean by that is dehumanization. You know, maybe it's even seemingly small things, how we use language, how we use words, jokes, metaphors, stereotypes, cliches. How do we talk about people who are different than us on the surface? I think we need to pay attention to that. Language is important. Words matter. Stories matter. And if you can dehumanize a group of people in a systematic way, after that, you can do whatever you want. Imagine today, as we're speaking, it is unfortunately a very sad anniversary of the day of the Yazidi genocide, when fanatics enslaved people, women and children, killed people just because they were different in their eyes. Now, what makes an ISIS militant to do this is the assumption that the Yazidi people are not human beings. They are dehumanized. And I can give you many other examples. So that kind of dehumanization, that kind of racism, sexism, fanaticism, unfortunately, it's not something we have left back in history. It is still happening again and again. And that's why I wanted to emphasize that we need to be careful about how dehumanization works. And at the end of the day, I think literature is an act of resistance in a way. Literature tries to rehumanize people who have been dehumanized by telling us forgotten stories, forsaken stories, but also censored stories.
Well, yeah, with everything that's happening in the world at the moment and the stories that are being written, and some of them true, some of them not, it's not surprising that we get fearful or angry, that we have anxiety. And anger, you say, is the emotion with the longest memory. So yeah. How do we accept that fear and anger are there without being overwhelmed by it?
Anger is the emotion with the longest memory. Also, when we inherit the memory of anger, we also inherit sometimes the memories of generations before us, our ancestors, the injustices, inequalities that they went through. And that story is incredibly important. And again, we're living this, as we're speaking right now, with Black Lives Matter, with young people on the streets, people asking for justice, and telling, wait a minute, what about my story? You know, how come my story has been silenced and suppressed for so long? So I do recognize the importance of anger. But what worries me is anger in the long run can be quite repetitive. And it can also be a bit tribal, because it can push us into a certain, towards a certain tribe of like-minded people. And we need to be very careful about that. All the writers that we respect so much, for instance, like Toni Morrison, they've always talked about recognizing anger, but then turning anger into something more constructive, more positive. You know, what do you do with that emotion? To be honest, rather than anger, rather than anxiety, what really worries me is numbness, is indifference. The moment we become desensitized, I think that is the most dangerous feeling, is when we lose all feeling, because then we stop caring about each other's stories, because then it doesn't really matter whether it's 5,000 refugees or 500,000 refugees who have drowned in the sea. You know, numbers don't mean anything if we have arrived at that moment of indifference. And so numbness is the emotion that I think we should also be talking about and be challenging constantly.
You say we have to become better listeners to people who have different stories to tell. And in doing so, we might learn from our differences between ourselves and other people. But at some point, we have to take sides, don't we, if we think that liberty or truth or freedom is under threat.
For me, to be a good listener is not a passive thing, you know, it's an active participation. And I think we have forgotten that, again, because of the age we're living in. When we turn on our TVs, we always, almost always see two speakers who take opposite sides. And the louder they speak, the more they clash. It's higher ratings, it's better ratings. This is the format that we are seeing almost every day. And what we're forgetting more and more is how to speak in a more nuanced way and to think in a more nuanced way. Now, that does not mean that we should not defend our values. I think we should be very passionate about defending our values. But always keep in mind that there are stories out there that we might not be aware of. And it's always important to listen to people who think differently, who vote differently. Allow me to give you maybe a different example. I come from a country that has been polarized extremely and bitterly politicized. And I think it is not a coincidence that in country after country where we have seen populist authoritarianism rise, we've seen also an extreme polarization. Now, the only people who benefit from that kind of tension, from that kind of polarization, are the demagogues themselves. So again, it's not a coincidence that when you look at how these autocrats behave or the demagogues behave, they're always trying to create a very deep division in societies and make sure that people do not listen to each other because they benefit from that extreme polarization. So I think as storytellers, we need to also find ways to overcome that. Now, I'm not denying the fact that we should be very vocal about our values, but we can do that just at the same time, we can be good listeners, good communicators, and remember that at the end of the day, we're making a choice. Are we going to build walls or are we going to build bridges? And I think the number of people who should be building bridges, if our number increases, maybe we can move forward in a better way. But walls will only create more indifference and make us more numb towards each other. From which only the demagogues will benefit.
Most people listening to this will have grown up half their lives, at least, in, you know, accessing the internet. But not enough knowledge or wisdom, in your opinion, is being shared. What's the difference between those three concepts: information, knowledge, and wisdom?
Yes, I think we have put so much emphasis on information for so long. This is the age of information. We said to ourselves, there are all these assumptions that if you give people enough information, they will always make the right choices. None of that turned out to be true. In fact, we are bombarded by information, yes, let alone misinformation and disinformation. There's a lot of that as well, but it doesn't mean that it helps us to make the right choices. In fact, oftentimes it either causes confusion, or again, it leads us slowly towards apathy. Why? Because we can't process this much information. You know, if I'm just scrolling up and down, just checking the news, it really doesn't register. It really doesn't stay with me unless I know the stories behind the news that I'm just, glancing through. So I do make a distinction between information, knowledge, and wisdom. And I think they're completely separate things. Unfortunately, in this age, we have a lot of information, less knowledge, and even less wisdom. So maybe one of our central aims to be to change that ratio. We need less information, more knowledge, and much, much more wisdom. Knowledge comes to us from books, from in-depth analysis, from investigative journalism. For knowledge to exist, we need to slow down and look deeper and spend more time, focus. So you can't just skim through, you know? That's information bombardment. That's not what I'm talking about. And then wisdom is something else altogether. I think wisdom, in a way, brings the mind and the heart together. And wisdom requires emotional intelligence. Again, for that, we need stories. So my point is, this much bombardment of information is actually not helping us at all. And we need to promote more knowledge. We need to promote more emotional intelligence, the empathy that comes with it. And also we need to encourage more wisdom.
Reading your work, it seems that overall, the enemy, for want of a better word, is within us, is the desire or the need for simplicity when the world is a much more complex and nuanced place. And you say that the way to fight this is to imagine lives beyond the one we're living, beyond the insanity of 24-hour news, towards a blend of what you call conscious optimism and creative pessimism. At the risk of oversimplifying this message, ironically, what's the one thing do you think the listener could do to begin this journey towards sanity and complexity?
I think the need for simplicity is very human, isn't it? It's very understandable, because in a world where so much is happening so fast, we long for simplicity, we long for safety, we want comfort, and I'm not judging any of that. But what I'm saying is, this is a very dangerous crossroads, because it's exactly when the demagogue enters into the picture. The demagogue says, you know what, I'm going to make it simple for you. I'm just follow me. Just, I have the recipe. It's a very simple recipe. And that's an illusion. That's a lie. The world we're living in is complex. It is very complicated, multi-layered. We have multiple challenges ahead. And these are global challenges, starting with climate emergency, or whether it's cyber terrorism, or the possibility of another pandemic, or financial crisis. We cannot pretend it's not happening. So rather than following a demagogue who promises us false simplicity, I think it's better to understand, to accept the fact that we are living in a complicated age. We won't find solutions in one day, in one go, and we will be struggling, but in that struggle itself, we are not alone. Many people, in fact, are feeling the same way. And for us to be able to understand that we are not alone, we need books, we need stories, we need to speak up. Also, we need multiple voices in the public space. We need the voices of women, the voices of diverse backgrounds, minorities. We need to speak up. I believe we've entered an age in which none of us can afford to be indifferent or apolitical, disengaged. We have to become more active citizens, both in the public space and the digital space. By this, I'm not referring to party politics. I'm not necessarily interested in that. And I'm definitely not interested in partisan politics. But to be political, to be vocal about core issues like rule of law, freedom of speech, human rights, women's rights, equality, these are the issues that matter enormously today. And I think when we hear each other's voices, when we read each other's stories, we retreat into an individual space, like an inner garden. We're not affected by other people's energy that much. And when we read a book, maybe we're a little bit more open to connect with the other. And that is a part of the big fight against dehumanization. You know, we have to find ways in which we can connect with people who think differently, who might have different names, But we need to be able to go beyond our own comfort zones and beyond our own tribes.
Well, Alif, I love the way you embrace the world in all its multitudes, and your work is an inspiration. Thanks for sharing your Omi with Bokomi today.
Thank you so much, Richard. It means a lot to me. Thank you.
Alif's book, How to Stay Sane in an Age of Division, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new non-fiction, sign up to our most wanted email at bokomi.com. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bokomi pod, please let us know by following or subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Stay safe, sane, and remember, the story of the future begins today. Bye for now.